Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So we're back after a little break. Welcome back. Facing a few big events coming up in France in the next few weeks, few months.
Yeah, European elections are just around the corner, early June, and the government is a bit nervous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Faced with polls that show a probable win for the far right.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll definitely get into that here because that is a tricky bit of politics there. And then, of course, the Olympics kick off late July, followed by the Paralympics.
And a lot of people are asking if Paris, where most of the events are being held, is ready.
Yeah, yeah. So sort of, but not quite.
Ish.
I suppose, like most Olympic host cities, Paris is scrambling and the questions are coming in fast. We just passed 100 days from the opening ceremony,
which is planned to be held along the banks of the River Seine. That should be absolutely amazing if it works.
Yeah, if it works. There are a lot of issues there, particularly security. How do you ensure this for this big open air event? There are concerns, particularly after a couple of terror attacks were foiled earlier this year.
And there are ongoing worries that the Israel-Gaza conflict will spill over into France, which has Europe's largest Muslim and Jewish populations.
So the government says now there are plan Bs, plan Cs in the works for the opening ceremony. Also, there's the prospect, of course, in France of public sector workers going on strike during the period, including transport workers. So there are frantic negotiations going on. Train drivers, for example, have already obtained changes to their pension rights using Olympics as the leverage.
Yeah, of course, not officially, but when it comes down to it, it's all about that. The government must be taking painkillers, you reckon. But both they and the Olympic Committee are really still beating the drum for what should still be an amazing event and a display of, you know, this incredible athletic prowess and bring people together. At the end of the day, it usually does. Il aimerait que je dévoile tous mes défauts. Il me défie, je mets l'effort, mais il revient malgré tous mes efforts. La frontière entre ce qui me plaît vraiment et ce qui vous fera plaisir. À chaque fois, je recommence pourtant. Ma vie et mes vœux, jetés en pâture. Oli m'a dit, donne tout pour les gens. Tout ça, c'est grâce à eux. Mais j'en suis pas sûr. So we're talking now about les jeunes. Yeah, literally the youth.
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of a catch-all phrase in French, les jeunes. It's used to describe an entire group of people aged, what, 0 to 25?
Yeah, at least, I guess. Yeah, just people that adults don't agree with, maybe. It's never really clear, is it? But that term, les jeunes, is used a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And these days, if you follow the French news, you've been hearing a lot about les jeunes over the past few weeks. President Macron, Prime Minister Gabriel Attal have been focusing in particular on what to do with what Macron has called ultra-violence among young people. This comes after a few very unfortunate incidents of true horrific violence. Most recently, a teenager was beat to death by a group of his peers outside his school. And of course, following last year's riots sparked by the police shooting of the teen Nahel, who didn't stop at a traffic stop, Macron highlighted at the time what he said were very young people involved in the rioting.
Tu casses, tu répares, tu salis, tu nettoies, tu défies l'autorité, on t'apprend à la respecter.
You break it, you fix it, you mess it up. You clean it, you defy authority, we teach you to respect it. So that's Attal speaking last week outside the school where the teenager was beaten to death. And he was announcing a slew of measures aimed at middle schoolers, so 11 to 15-year-olds, to try to rein them in, reestablish authority, and curb violence. This week, he launched an experimental scheme in which troublemakers are to be sent to military-style boarding schools for a few weeks to try to reset their behavior.
He would like students with a history of making trouble to have that actually officially recorded on their report cards along with their grades.
Yeah.
Also, he thinks that parents should get punished for their kids' actions.
Yeah, all of this in the name of reestablishing authority, something that the conservative right has long been pushing for. That phrase, you break it, you fix it, has become a kind of mantra for Attal.
Tu casses, tu répares, tu salis, tu nettoies, tu défies l'autorité, on t'apprend à la respecter.
Here he is in January giving a speech to Parliament, laying out his government's plans. He started using the phrase back in 2020 when he was the government spokesperson. So we have a government that is currently very concerned about what they say is a lack of respect for authority and a rise in violence among young people, les jeunes.
But is there actually a rise? Mm. You know, a lot of people are questioning the very premise.
Yeah, yeah. And they do point to studies and statistics, some even coming from the government themselves, that shows that violent crime committed by young people is not particularly on the rise these days.
I don't see why the dramatic evolution everybody's talking every year, every month, every week, I don't see it. The trend over more than 20 years is overall stability. And this is a latent venial of all the political speeches that we have been hearing again, you know, in recent week in France.
Laurent Mukiele is a sociologist who's long studied youth delinquency. And he says that throughout his decades-long career, politicians have always been decrying youth.
Youth violence is a classic topic of French public debate. It constitutes a resource for political power, which uses it on a regular basis. I don't think there's been a single year when I haven't heard this theme in the mouth of politicians in the media, and particularly, of course, during election period, which is the case now in France. And the arguments are always the same. Local criminal stories relayed by the media and figures taken from police statistics. And the general messages are always the same. It's getting worse and worse. Young people are increasingly violent and precocious. Teachers no longer have any maturity. Prevention is no longer enough. And justice is too lax. I have really been hearing this for 27 years.
So he mentions electoral politics, and we are in an election period with the European Parliament elections coming at the beginning of June.
Yeah, yeah. And the far right is polling way ahead of Macron's party. Talking about the kids being more violent today than back in the day is, you know, a good way to tap into fears of older conservative voters that Macron is hoping to squeeze away from the right. And Mukiele also points out that politicians talking about les jeunes, young people, are actually talking about certain young people from certain backgrounds.
It should also be noted that in the French context, when a politician speaks of youth violence, he also implicitly refers to young people from immigrant backgrounds. Since the end of the 80s, this theme of youth violence has been really linked to the theme of drugs, to that of riots, and to that of what we call now religious radicalization, which obviously concerns Islam in France. And it is likely that Mr. Macron's government is seeking both to reassure its electorate and to contain the extreme right vote, which places even greater emphasis on these themes.
Now, all this isn't to say that there is no violence. Mm-hmm. There is a growing concern about the influence and power of gangs running criminal activities in some poorer neighborhoods around the country. They do attract young people, drawn by promises of easy money and glamorous lifestyles. But as Mukiele says, it's often in the context of a lack of any other opportunities around them.
The real reasons for youth delinquency, and I don't talk about kids who committed small offenses for fun, which is very commonplace. So, but those young people are really engaged into a delinquent way of life. So the real reasons of this kind of delinquency, we can see that this generally results from the accumulation of three main factors. The first one is the fact of having grown up in a very conflictual family. The second fact is the fact of failing at school. And the third one is the fact of growing and living in a very disadvantaged neighborhood. And therefore, if the politicians really want to change the situation, they have to work on those social and generational determinants, which are very heavy, let's say, in society.
So lots to unpick there. A government faced with criminal gangs and neighborhoods that are lacking economic opportunities and social investments. It is somewhat easier to blame the young people than to address the systemic problems, especially when you're facing an increasingly aging and right-leaning electorate. Mukiele reminds us that going after young people in France is not actually new.
It began approximately at the end of the first part of the 19th century, a period we used to call la monarchie de juillet, July's monarchy. At that time, the commentators focused especially on prostitution among girls, and on vagrancy among boys. And the main response was internment. Street boys are seen as habitual thieves and potential rioters, and they frightened political power and the Parisian bourgeoisie. Then in the last 1950s and early 60s, the press called them black jackets in reference to rock and roll fashion. Then since the 1980s, the terms jeune de banlieue, suburban youth, has become commonplace. But it's always more or less the same story, a story of fear and, to put it simply, a story of the contempt of the rich for the poor.
So there's a lot of talk right now. Technically, for the next 2 months, the government's holding one of its famous concertations or public consultations on what to do about this issue of youth violence. Concretely, authorities in the French Caribbean Department of Guadeloupe, for example, have imposed a curfew for minors in the main city of Pointe-à-Pitre. And in the southern city of Béziers, the far-right mayor has imposed a curfew for all kids. Too soon to tell, though, if this authoritarian approach will solve anything. Ce qui se façonne avec le temps s'en va avec le temps. Et c'est les têtards qui se prennent pour les meilleurs de tous les temps. Femme, femme, quand cesserez-vous d'être aveugle? Quels sont les avantages que vous avez recueillis dans la Révolution? Un mépris plus marqué, un dédain plus signalé.
So, 80 years ago this week, women in France got the right to vote.
Not so long ago.
No, and it was later than most other countries in Europe. Jess Phelan is here to tell us all about it. Hi, Jess.
Hello. Yeah, that's right. So in most of Europe, women got the right to vote in the years immediately after World War One. But France took until the 21st of April, 1944, to extend suffrage to women. Women had been calling for it, though. Historian Anne-Sara Moelik has written a book about how women got the vote in France. And she told me that generations of women campaigned for the right, but their contribution tends to be overlooked.
These women, these feminists, they were looking for a better world. They wanted to be included in Republic. And not as women, they just wanted to be part of this big and beautiful thing that is democracy.
So Jess, who were these women who were campaigning for the right to vote?
Well, one of the first was the writer Olympe de Gouges. Ah. After the French Revolution of 1789, France famously adopted the Declaration of the Rights of Man, and de Gouges responded with her Declaration of the Rights of Woman. And she argued that women have to abide by laws just like men do, so they should have the same power to make those laws by voting and by being in government.
Ah. Radical thoughts.
Right, well, it was definitely too radical for the time. Olympe de Gouges was later guillotined.
Oh.
And it was a really turbulent time with these revolutions followed by counter-revolutions, progress followed by backlash.
But at the time, even not all men could vote, could they?
Yeah, so the law went back and forth a few times, but basically the right for most French men to vote was only established for good in 1848. And pretty much as soon as that was established, women started objecting to it. So in 1849, the first woman ran for parliament in France. Her name was Jeanne de Rouen, and it was an act of protest. She knew she wouldn't be elected.
Although, like, if she had been elected, I guess she probably wouldn't have been able to even take her seat.
Right, exactly, yeah. Because women could neither vote nor hold elected office. So after that, there was another coup in France, and democracy was kind of on hold for several decades. So things stalled again until the 1870s. And that's when France went back to being a republic and women started campaigning for more rights. Things like access to education, the right to get divorced and to keep their own property. And out of this movement, a woman called Hubertine Auclair said, it's not enough to revise these laws. We have to be able to make them in the first place. And she founded the first French group that was dedicated to campaigning specifically for women's suffrage.
So this must have been around about the same time that the suffragette movement was taking off back in the UK. So these are the women who took really drastic action to campaign for the vote, like destroying property, going on hunger strike, chaining themselves to the railings in front of Parliament. Mm-hmm. Some even died for the cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the movement in France was very different to that. A few women did engage in civil disobedience, but on the whole, they were much less radical.
In France, women weren't on the same kind of action. They prefer this respectable approach, legalist approach, to show that they could be part of this republic and they would obey the law.
So Moalik says that's to do with the historical context. France had had a century of revolutions and upheaval, and now it was finally relatively stable. So women suffragists wanted to prove that they could be trusted to respect that. They didn't want to alarm people by using these extreme tactics.
Okay, so instead of that, what were they doing instead?
They were giving speeches, holding rallies, petitioning, and they did get the matter raised in France's parliament several times. Between 1919 and 1936, bills to grant women the vote were passed six times in the lower house of parliament, but every single time the upper house got in the way.
The Sénat.
Yes, the Sénat. So again, it was about stability. The senators saw themselves as protecting this fragile status quo, and they thought if women could vote, it might just throw everything back into chaos. And it wasn't just conservatives. Even progressives at the time thought that women tended to be more religious than men. Maybe they'd vote really conservatively and actually move France backwards.
The fear of women.
So what finally made the difference?
Well, it turns out you do actually need a bit of chaos for things to change. Here's the historian Anne-Sara Moalik again.
We have to have a look at the very moment where voting rights were granted everywhere. All the countries of Central Europe, Germany, Austria, etc. Women were granted the vote between around 1918 and 1920. Why? Because it was a time after the empire crashed. We had to write new laws for a new constitution for all these countries. And in France, it's just the same. Why 1944? Well, in 1918, the institutions were strong enough not to be broken with the First World War. And after that, we have a great stability. It all shattered with the Second World War and the regime of Vichy. There, the Third Republic collapsed. And so we had to build something new. And that is the moment of 1944. Where vote is granted at last to French women.
So Charles de Gaulle's provisional government passed a decree giving women the right both to vote and to take office in 1944.
But at that moment, France was still at war, so there weren't any elections. When did women actually get the chance to vote?
There were municipal elections on the 29th of April, 1945, and there are still women around today who voted on that date for the very first time. Marcel Abadie was 24 then, she's 104 now, and she still remembers what that was like.
Oh, c'était un événement, et ça nous a marqué. Moi, je sais que... Même encore maintenant, ben, il m'arrive d'y penser.
So she said that was quite an event. It marked us. She went and got her hair done, especially that morning, and right up to the last minute, she couldn't quite believe that it was happening.
Je me rappelle de ça. J'étais un petit peu craintive parce que je me disais.
I was a bit nervous, she says. I wondered, would I make the right choice? So she asked people around her, and everyone had a different opinion, but in the end, she voted for who she wanted. And she says it was like that was the day that she became an adult.
C'était une journée importante dans ma vie. Et ce jour-là, j'ai eu l'impression que j'étais devenue adulte.
That was voter Marcel Abadie speaking to RFI's Laurence Théo. And you can find more of my interview with historian Anne-Sara Moalik on our website, rfienglish.com.
We now head to the theatre, Sarah.
Mesdames, Mesdemoiselles, Messieurs, bonsoir et bienvenue au Théâtre de la Huchette.
To one of Paris's tiniest venues, the Théâtre de la Huchette. It's in the Latin Quarter, not far from Notre Dame Cathedral, sandwiched between a Greek and a Chinese takeaway. But you could easily miss it, but it's become world famous.
Not because of its neighbours. It's fast food, I guess. I have heard of this theatre, though. Why is it so famous?
Well, since 1957, it's been running two short plays by the French-Romanian avant-gardist playwright Eugène Ionesco, five times a week, non-stop, with their original decor and staging from the 50s. Mm. The plays are La Leçon, The Lesson, and Ionesco's first work, the renowned La Cantatrice Chauve, The Bald Soprano.
Edward the clerk, his sister Nancy the typist, and his brother William, a shop assistant.
Drôle de famille.
Oh, j'aime mieux un oiseau dans un champ qu'une chaussette dans une brouette.
Plutôt un filet dans un chalet que du lait dans un palais.
La maison d'un anglais et son vrai palais.
So the bald soprano is set in England in the late 19th century at the home of a petit bourgeois couple, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and they're, you know, they're sort of trapped in this non-communication after 20 years of clearly boring marriage, and they welcome Mr. and Mrs. Martin, a couple who no longer recognise one another.
Mm.
So it all sounds a bit mad, but there is a breakdown in communication, which, you know, many critics have seen as a critique of our dysfunctional modern society. Now, in March this year, 30 years after Ionesco died in Paris, the theatre put on its 20,000th performance of both plays.
20,000? That's a lot of plays.
It is. Only Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap has run for longer and in London and with more performances, but that's been in several different theatres, whereas this one has been in the same place the whole time, so that's a bit of a record.
Wow. All right. So kind of a historical look there. Although it's hard to imagine, like, the same play being done every day. How does this not get boring? I mean, I guess as a viewer, maybe you're not seeing it many times, but the performers?
Yeah, you do wonder. I think for the public, there's a myth around this play, so people are sometimes coming back to see it precisely because it is the same as it was in 1957.
Sure.
So there's an attraction at the level of the audience, but I agree, for the cast, you just think, my God, how boring, doing the same thing day in, day out.
Yeah.
You wonder how they keep the energy, the enthusiasm, the spark going. I went along to find out.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Franck, enchanté.
Enchanté, ravi.
Ça va?
Oui, très bien. Ravi de vous recevoir.
Super.
It's 5 p.m., just 2 hours before the curtain goes up on the 20,024th performance of The Bald Soprano, followed an hour later by The Lesson. Frank Demet, the theatre's director, has his head in paperwork in his office in the basement. He took over the theatre 10 years ago.
It's a mythic and traditional theatre. It's a unique story because we have here 45 actresses and actors, and it's the last theatre who had a troupe.
Permanent troupe.
And this theatre is very rich because of those persons. It's our theatre. They feel here at home. So it's a family.
You know, when you enter the Théâtre de la Huchette, it's like you enter in religion.
Didier Bailly joined the family 38 years ago when he was 30 years old and soon began playing the role of Mr. Martin in The Bald Soprano.
You know, my partners, all the actors at that time were about 50 years old, and I was 30, so I had old wives. And, you know, fortunately, I had no hair.
Even
I
then,
was a bit bald. But I had a very, very young face. So it was a bit special. And they said, oh, you know, it's absurd. So it's okay,
fine.
It's fine. But I don't know.
And what role do you play at the moment?
I've just changed because I was Mr. Martin. Now, because I'm old, I've become Mr. Smith.
And he's an older character.
At the beginning, they had all the same... same age, because they were a company of youngsters.
Right.
Okay. So they were about 25. But with the time and the change of actors, we kind of, that's one thing we change a little bit. We think it's interesting that the Smiths are older and they are in a stage of a relation that the Martins hasn't reached yet.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Ça a été mon épouse pendant très longtemps. Mrs. Martin.
So, Hélène Cohen, you play the role of Mrs. Martin.
Tonight.
And how long have you been playing this role?
Depuis 2013. Peu plus de 10 ans, 11 ans, quoi.
So, a bit more than 10 years, 10, 11 years. How on earth do you keep the passion and the freshness when you've been playing the same role for more than a decade?
Écoutez, en fait, on joue jamais avec les mêmes partenaires.
You know, it's because we never stick with the same partner. That's what's great. It means you have to keep adapting. There are always surprises. And we work intermittently, 1 or 2 weeks every 2 months. So the rest of the time we work on other projects, and it's stimulating. When you come back to the role, you're no longer the same person. We're also very lucky to have Didier Bailly over here as our coach. Every week he gets us together to help us to refine our performances, so it stops the routine setting in.
Do you know why you were chosen for this role? How did you get it?
J'étais là déjà, en fait. Je jouais la leçon de Ionesco.
In fact, I was already acting in the other Ionesco play, The Lesson, playing the female student. I was young, about 20 when I started, so I've been at this theatre for, well, between 30 and 40 years. Didier was here before me. After about 20 years playing in The Lesson, I thought I should hand it over to the younger generation. And then I was offered the role of an older woman, Mrs. Martin, in The Bald Soprano.
Mais alors, nous nous sommes peut-être rencontrés dans cette maison, chère madame.
Oh, c'est bien possible, mais je ne m'en souviens pas, cher monsieur.
Mon appartement est au 5e étage, c'est le numéro 8, chère madame.
So I wonder, Hélène, given that being an actor is quite a precarious job, it's not easy, but in fact, you've been able to have steady work since the age of 20.
Oui, je me sens tout à fait privilégiée. Enfin, surtout pour les femmes, en fait.
I feel very privileged, especially as a woman, because it's more complicated for us than for male actors. There are fewer roles for older women. So we're very lucky to be part of this troupe and to be able to carry on in the profession.
Oui, oui, tout à fait.
Hélène Cohen heads off to prepare her hair and makeup before the show, and we follow her upstairs to the dressing room. Ah, here we are.
So you can see that each actor has a box.
Yeah, there are seven.
Place of Mrs. Martin. Of Mrs. Martin, of the maid. Ah, here comes the maid, Nicole.
Bonjour, Nicole.
Bonjour, mademoiselle. Je joue le rôle de la bonne dans la
I play the role of the maid in The Lesson and in The Bald Soprano. It's been more than 30 years now.
Another actress that's been performing for more than 30 years. You still love doing this?
Oh, oui. C'est formidable.
Oh, yes, it's wonderful.
Originally, it was Mr. Smith who played the maid in The Lesson because they think he had to be very strong in front of the teacher and dominant. It was a bit absurd. Some of them had
a beard,
and they play the maid with a beard. Yes.
Hello, good evening, and welcome.
Hello. And who is this?
Mr. Martin.
My husband.
Your husband.
I'm Donald Martin.
Hello, Donald Martin.
And who are you?
My name is Alison. I'm doing a little report on 67 years of doing the same thing.
You know, we enter the theatre here.
Okay, so opening a door just on the side of this very small stage, which is, I don't know,
4 meters and 5 meters or six.
Really not very big at all. So all we have on the set here, I'm just looking, we have a bench for two people, a chair and a stool. Exactly. And a little table here at the back with a lamp on
it.
It could hardly be simpler as a staging.
Exactly. It's the living room of the Smiths.
And we are in England.
In England, exactly. And you know, in France, normally we don't use the colour green on stage, you
That's
know?
Right.
And you see, all the set is green. And the costume of the corsage of Mrs. Smith is green.
And that was something that Ionesco wanted? Or
the director, Nicolas Bataille.
Right.
The director and the decorator, Jacques Noël, who was one of the greatest decorators in the French theatre for years.
The one who chose to bring the green colour onto the stage. Break all the codes.
And break all the codes, exactly.
I can hear people starting to come in. Yeah. How do you explain that 67 years later, these two plays are still so popular?
I think because the text is fantastic.
And still very relevant, pertinent, do you think,
yes.
In this day and age?
Yes, yes, yes. You know, the relations between a couple, people who are married for years and they can't stand each other, and it doesn't change. In the caves, there were probably problems of communication between women and men.
So they end up just having meaningless conversation, and that in itself is an absurdist
message in a way, just how meaningless language can be.
Can be, exactly. And we had a very important character, the fireman, in the direction of Nicolas Bataille. The costume is a costume of a British Bobby. So it represents the order, you know. The play was written just after the war, 4 years after the war. So this kind of fear of the order, fear of authority, but also for fascism, because this fireman can be a Gestapist or something like that. He comes to ask them if they're hidden fire. But you can hear, are you hiding Jews or are you hiding drugs? It's eternal. I mean, the fear of the fascism. And at the moment where in countries of Europe, there's the shadow of, you know, the extreme right political parties. I think it's relevant.
Still relevant.
Still.
Yeah. Have you ever played the policeman?
No, never. I learned the big monologue because it was important for me to work on it at home. But no, I played once Mrs. Smith because we had an absurd night of absurdity once or twice. So an actress played Mr. Smith and I played Mrs. Smith.
And how did that feel?
Oh, it's a dream. I was not in a drag queen at all. I only had the costume. But no makeup, no wig. And it was a bold Mrs. Smith, and she was not the soprano.
So that's definitely a way of injecting new energy into a role after 30 years, for sure.
For sure, yes, yeah. Indeed.
Can you imagine stopping one day?
Death will be the judge.
So, Alison, who has been coming to see these plays over 20,000 times?
More than 2 million people so far.
Wow.
So, yeah, big numbers. I was told around a third are French, many from Paris, people coming back who maybe saw the play decades ago and are now showing it to their kids or their grandkids. A third of them are tourists. And then a third, school children who are maybe studying UNESCO.
Right. It's there. Why not go see it?
Yeah. Well, exactly. You kind of need to see a play, really, if you're studying it. The theatre, by the way, puts on a subtitle version in English on Wednesdays. And during the Olympics, every showing will be subtitled.
Ah, the Olympics. Once again, another thing to come out of these Olympic Games.
En Paris s'éveille au mois d'avril, quand le soleil revient d'exil.
That's it for the show. This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompeani.
Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International. You could send in your questions about France or just say hi. Write to us. We're at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
If you like the show, please consider rating or even reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. Believe it or not, it does help people find the show. You can also look for us on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
We'll be back in 2 weeks' time on Thursday, May the 9th. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison.
En avril.